Talk us through, Andy, your view of the transition from, you know, the amateur to the professional game.
Well, yeah, again, it's a well sort of a question that is asked a lot of me and Harry and what the difference is really. It was just a case of, you know, for instance, in the amateur area, so I worked at Whitbread's, in my personal circumstances, I got up at sort of like 5 o'clock, got to work for 5:30, worked till 2, got back on my bike then, went to a gym, worked out for an hour and a half, went home, had something to eat on Tuesdays, perhaps Wednesday we play, Thursday train, Tuesday train, play, Wednesday train, Thursday, day off Friday, as in no nothing, and then all the way through that we worked. And so it was long days, it was dedicated, and no money, no all you got sort of thing was, you know, the actual sort of the honour of pulling on cherry and white, which was enough. No one batted an eyelid in those days, no one thought any different of it, no one complained, no one even wanted it to change, because change never was on the horizon. That was the way generations before me had done it, and, you know, not very, obviously no one after me really, but the fact is it changed overnight when people say, right, and Richard Hill called me in, he said, oh, I was shat, and he said, I'm going to put you on a year's contract because of my age, because I was about 31, I think I was at the time, something like that, and he said, put you on a year's contract, which he did, and I'm going to give you this money to do it. And like, you sort of, like I said, as well documented what I said, like, you know, it was just like winning the pools, it really was, where, what, we haven't got to go to work, and we're just going to do this for a living now then. Is that right? And then, you know, he says, yeah, that's it. And then Richard, in them days, he used to get you in 9 to 5 then, sort of thing, and fill up the day with whatever. But we could have been there 9 till 10. It made no difference to us because we weren't going to work, and we actually loved what we were doing. So, you know.
And presumably at the start of the professional era, you didn't have an agent or anything?
No, we didn't have at the start, I didn't, no. Because, you know, it was, you know, In them days, I think Richard was quite fair with the money that the contracts that they gave out. You know, he probably said, I'd do it for half the money, I'd do it, sort of thing. You know, I had a mortgage, I had 2 young kids, and I was taking a major risk in going professional. I was lucky enough that I worked for Whitbreds, and they sponsored me all the way through, which was lovely of them, sort of thing. And I could have gone back at any time, which was always nice to know. And you know, it was very good to me. But I then, from then, you had that thought, and then what they did, the change was then of how you did it. That was a major thing. Like, you know, people realised that you couldn't train and train and train and train and play. You just couldn't, because it would just affect the performance. And now, and I was in this conversation.
So did that routine change quite a lot during your professional career?
I had this conversation this week that I would say the routine changes every year, and that's why I can't never get my head around. Well, has net someone got to the point of sort of like how we do it, how we warm up, how the technique of warming up, how the technique of lifting weights, how the technique of how long you lift them for, what exercises you do to get that, you know what I mean? How long, you know, because we used to run for miles. Yeah, and now sort of like the guys are all very short, sharp, power, and, you know, very much game related, stop, start. But, you know, they used to time us on 3,000 metres, you know what I mean? And used to, you know, how quick you could do a 3,000 metres, and that was, but now you wouldn't do that now, sort of thing, like, do you know what I mean? And I was lucky enough that I had a very good engine in me that, you know, that I could run for a biggish man for a long time. I was very dedicated in sort of like how I trained. I trained hard, and I trained hard day in, day out, really. And I was always aware how lucky I was to have what I had, and I didn't want to give it up. And I was very aware of my age at the time, that I had to work harder than most to keep where I wanted to be, because if I could meet the stats that they wanted, and if I was doing it 65, they can't say that I'm not meeting what, obviously you've got to perform on the pitch, but a lot to do in them days as well is, you know, well, how strong is he? You know, they had a look, and that affected people's selection as well, sort of thing. You went through the training, but now it's very very short, sharp, very power orientated in and speed and sort of like, you know, agility and skill base. You know, the guys work on a skill. There's a different brand of rugby player coming through now because their skills are so much better because they've got time to do it. You know, my skills improved drastically. In 18 months, I've put on nearly 2 stone. My body fat reduced by at least 5%. Do you know what I mean? So, and your body changes overnight. You know, it's dramatic. But you always thought you was quite strong, quite fit, using the amateur era. But, you know, I would say, obviously, I'm in Sydney for rugby club now. I would say National One Division players are now fitter than, say, like Gloucester players were back in the amateur days. And that's level three. And they do it for amateur as in Gloucester. But these guys are, they've been brought through on a regime of it now. And, you know, if you are going to be a decent rugby player, you've got to be fit and strength and like all the things I said previous. But those were the things that brought that change dramatically. You know, the science of it and how you did it, length of time, and how, you know, the recording of it, you know, all that. And I was lucky enough to sort of like, you know, that used to sort of like put me out there as a bit of a pioneer, as in for the youngsters coming through, because I was quite dedicated in what I did. And, you know, they used to sort of help me up as sort of like a bit of a role model because I was of my age as well, sort of thing. So the two worked well for them and for me, really, sort of thing, which is nice for me.
Because in your amateur days, you know, most of the players for Gloucester were Gloucester born and bred. And you know, one of the major changes with the professional was, you know, suddenly there were players from all around the world coming to join Gloucester. How did that feel like in the team?
Again, yeah, it was, I think, if you go around the world, and that's the good thing about rugby, is that people can settle in quite easy because they are a rugby player, and I think, you know, wherever you play around the world, it ain't too much different of rugby guys and their mentality, sort of thing. They do things and their outlook on life really is pretty similar. And I think these guys came in. It was exciting. I must admit, it was really exciting, especially when, like, you know, Jason Little and Ian Jones, you know, not so much Terry Fan Lewis so much because he wasn't in that bracket at that time when he. Gloucester made Terry as opposed to sort of like Terry coming, even though he played in the World Cup for us, but he wasn't sort of a bigger name. But and sort of like all the people that have gone, you know, before then or after, it was a case of most of them, they added a bit something, you know what I mean? The top end were like Ian Jones, you know, he changed things, like, you know, and like Kingsley Jones but people did clash and I wouldn't say they didn't, and when you put a lot of cultures together, people are gonna clash. A lot of tension in the Saint-André early years when he filled it up with a lot of Frenchmen, sort of thing, like, do you know what I mean? And I think at one time there was 8 or 9, 10 Frenchmen in the squad, sort of thing, which was difficult. And people really couldn't understand it from a player point of view that he would pick some French guy from obscurity and sort of like try and make him a player at Gloucester, sort of thing, where in reality there was players in Gloucester or in local rugby you could sort of like cut it, really, do you know what I mean? And it's just as good. But you know, we felt a bit, you know, that he needed people around him of the same ilk, which would help him. And Saint-André, you know, from his point of view, from the management of a foreigner coming in, he did change the face of Gloucester. You know, go down in history. I think that as a player point of view, he did change it. Some things he changed were dramatically correct, and other things were, you know, wrong. He shouldn't have done what he did, but he did. But he was the boss in. That was it, and people, you know, live and die by it. But he did change things. He changed the culture, and he changed the side, and he got rid of a lot of people that who have been in Gloucester for a long time. And again, for me personally, I was quite proud that I went through that because, you know, there was a lot of axes at the time, and people that was going to fall, like, do you know what I mean, who were established. And, you know, if you can get through that, you felt that way, you know, you were in the right, like a football manager, basically. If a new football guy comes in, a football manager comes in and he picks you in that squad, he wants you in your squad, then it was quite satisfying and less worrying as well, sort of thing, because you know, you could get asked from different coaches to get in director of rugby, which is nice. And then from then, you know, Richard Nigel Marvel, sorry, came in, and you know, he was a totally different outlook, and Dean came in a totally different outlook on it altogether. And but, you know, I think if you could have put them all together, that they would sort of like, you know, you'd come up with the perfect one. But obviously, that's not to be. But it was, you know, from the actual foreigners coming in, yeah, I enjoyed it, and you know, I think they added something to it, which is good.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, John and I have probably a skewed view of this, having devoted ourselves to Gloucester Rugby Heritage as a project. But you know, I mean, we've interviewed quite a lot of players from the amateur era who themselves speak very strongly of how conscious they were of the heritage of the club in Gloucester. Do you think that gets across to the professional players coming in from elsewhere?
I think it's more difficult now. I think that the people like Brian Redpath, I think he's got a bigger he has got a bigger responsibility on that, because it was a natural thing that happened previously to him. Now, the reason, again, about myself, the longevity, the reason why, one of the reasons of my longevity of the career, it wasn't just about playing, it was just about instilling into Ian Jones, for instance, what this place is about. Because I was at an age there where I wasn't a youngster, I played for Gloucester a long time. I understood, and when Saint-André came as a player, we went through the same thing with him, and he grasped it, to be fair to him, he did grasp it, but he never forgot what he was taught or mentored or whatever the word may be, sort of thing, to understand what Gloucester was about. Now, he understood if he brought in new players, he had to have a nucleus in his squad that would say to that player, this is how we do it. Now, you're going to do it our way. If we don't do it our way, you're gone. And I would say, like a shop steward in that role, sort of thing, and for internationals who came in, and for like Simpson Daniel who came in, sort of thing, like, you know what I mean, he had to understand what it's about, and he had to respect the older players in the squad and what those older players and their requirements. And you know, sometimes, again, it was a brutally harsh environment sometimes, with the banter and sort of, like, you know, Mickey taking, and you know, people and peer pressures from players for performance levels as well, sort of thing, you know. And that's what Gloucester's been about. They've been very honest, and Gloucester players are very honest and very self-critical about their players and about their performance, and that they wouldn't be scared to view it amongst themselves, sort of thing, and they didn't care every word, really. But like I say, that was then, and as the people say of my ilk left, and Mark Cornwall, Chris Fawlty, those sort of people are very much Gloucester born and bred, play big parts. They then have to go into sort of like the management, and they understand the management of the club, that people come in, that, you know, they've got Peter Buxton, they've got Andy Hazel now, sort of thing. But like I say, it's only sort of like real snippets of people, as opposed to the masses then, sort of thing. So, but since Daniel, you know, he understands it. Nick Wood, he understands it, because of the length of time that they've been in there. And they, even though not from Gloucester, they still have the ability to sort of instill the Gloucester then into other new players, whether they come from Gloucester or not. It's interesting to read last night, or when Freddie Burr said he feels like a Gloucester boy, sort of thing, like, you know what I mean. And in another 2 years out of that contract, he'll be signed again, and he then will become that sort of player, as a Nick Wood or, you know, or Simpson Daniel, sort of thing. Yeah. But even though he comes from not around here, but he understands what is expected of a Gloucester player.
Who didn't fit into the culture?
I think some of the French guys who didn't get Saint-André came in, who didn't get first team games, who didn't understand it, and there was a bit homesick, and they didn't actually language barrier and stuff like that. That didn't help those sort of guys. Some Kiwis, naming no names, would come in, and they would say, you know, that they, as a Kiwi does, he's very strong about it, about his attitude and about his sort of like way that he thinks it can be done, and you know, sometimes it don't fit, and you know, clashes of people, sort of like, you know, Kingsley Jones, Ian Jones, you know, massive clashes in how they thought, not personal about people, but how they thought rugby should be played, the dynamics of the team, how it should be picked. Now, Ian Jones was captain, he resigned halfway through the year. Kingsley Jones came in as captain. Kingsley Jones was very vocal. Ian Jones was very example-led. He would do it, the troops would follow him. Kingsley would say, yeah, do it, but he would tell you all about it as well when he was doing it, sort of thing. He had great ability to speak and to sort of like run at the same time. And it seems a little things, but he was very good like that. He non-stop, his mind was working constantly all the way through, in at the referee, in at his own players, in at the opposition, and sort of like, you know, for Ian Jones's point of view, he couldn't see the why he had to sort of like talk so much. They clashed, you know, a lot, and you know, again, nationalities, the Welsh, Kiwis, you know, a Welshman's not telling a Kiwi what to do, sort of things, you know what I mean? And all that was going on as well. And an Englishman and a Frenchman, sort of thing. And Saint-André had his data and his training techniques and the people he employed. And he came under great pressure before he left, sort of thing, to leave. And a lot of it came from within, from his own squad, which was, and then once you have lost that, then it is time to go, sort of thing. So it was, you know, you went through these periods, but it was all, at the end of the day, if he was winning and he was on a good roll, you sort of like, you know, you could then paper over maybe a crack because he was winning. Now, if you start to lose, those cracks get bigger, and that's what you do now in the professional area, you move on.
Yeah. Would you say you enjoyed playing more amateur or professional rugby?
I prefer playing professional rugby, 100%.
Why do you say that?
I think because I also, as a person, I don't think I was the most sort of gifted man in the world, sort of like who ever played for Gloucester, sort of thing. And what I always did, I got myself into good shape, and I left no, you know, stone unturned to get to that point. So every time I went on the pitch, I knew I couldn't do no more to be than I am, sort of thing. Do you know what I mean? But and you didn't realise it when you're playing amateur rugby, but then you play sort of like professional rugby, you realise that, you know, I can't do no more than I'm doing, sort of thing, to make it happen for me. Professional rugby gave you that time and ability to actually maximise every sort of like, you know, bit of potential that you had, and which again you didn't realise it in the amateur era because you didn't know no different. But when you sort of certainly got into the professional area, you suddenly thought, yeah, I'm glad I'm doing it this way around, because, you know, like I say, you can actually sort of like, you know, maximise everything you got. And from a player that was, you know, had to be fit, I had to be strong, I had to be sort of like disciplined in everything I did, and that was my way, and that's why I played, and that was the way I trained, and the actual sort of like the professional ethos is sort of like, you know, it was a real good fit for me. And that was, again, looking back, when I'm older, as you can, and when you reflect, you can reflect, and that is why I ended up in what my career panned out to be, sort of thing. And again, like I said earlier in the interview, you don't always realise that when you're actually doing it, but on reflection, you know, it is a good thing.
Yeah.